Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by our sales coaching and consulting services. Are you looking to create repeatable, scalable, and predictable revenue? We've helped thousands of companies grow their business with tailored expert advice backed by testing to ensure they establish the best practices that'll work for them. Head over to bit.ly/predictable revenue coaching to learn more.
We're all familiar with hustle culture, rise and grind, CEOs and founders maintaining that the only route to business success is, you know, 4 a.m. starts, 18-hour workdays, pushing oneself to physical, emotional, and mental limits, all in an attempt to hit that coveted and incredibly rare $1 billion valuation. Many of us know that this is an unhealthy approach, but we do it anyway because we think it's the only way to prove ourselves, to improve the business, and to secure funding. But my guest is here to tell us that that is not true. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting with an expert about unicorn or bust. What's wrong with the growth at all costs model? He's the founder, partner of a growth equity firm called Peakspan Capital, which was founded with a core mantra of focus and specialization leading to success, coupled with contra Silicon Valley approach to working with entrepreneurs. They're huge proponents of sensible scaling, pragmatic decision-making, and iterative progress leading to enduring value. And Matt Melamuka, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We need you to do our opening spiel wherever we present or talk. That was emphatic and glorious. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, we're so happy to have you. Let's start right back with your contra Silicon Valley philosophy. Where did you guys come up with that? Where did it come from?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll give you just a little bit of a backdrop and context about kind of where we play in the investment landscape. So I'm a co-founder and partner at Peakspan. So My two co-founders and I really kind of started seeding the roots for Peakspan back at our prior firm over a decade ago. And so, you know, actually, interestingly, focus and specialization has always been core to what we do. A decade ago, just saying you were a B2B software investor was focused and specialized. You fast forward to today, it's a $400 billion annual spend market. And it's so, there's so many companies, there's so much capital, just doing that is not enough. And so a core mantra of ours, and I'll get into the Silicon Valley, a conscious Silicon Valley part in a minute, is just focus and specialization leading to success and being a great partner for the companies we work with. And so we actually limit the number of themes within B2B software that partners can focus on at our firm to three. And so I lead our sales tech, our marketing tech, and our hospitality tech team. That's all I do. And so a big part of our just kind of value add is really thought partnership and reading the same things, meeting the same people that our companies are, just so we can be really fluid in the level of rapport we have with these folks. And so, you know, back when we started working together, you know, we started seeing this unicorn mania kind of bubbling to the fore. And you fast forward to today, you know, it's kind of all you hear about sometimes. And sometimes in the blogosphere, you know, especially if you're an entrepreneur, it probably feels like the only way to do it, right? It's the only thing that's talked about. And I think, you know, some conferences and, you know, events that will remain nameless, there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of those. Like networking is great. It's fun to hear company stories. But when you put, you know, three Powerball winners up on stage and say, you know, how did you pick the winning numbers? And the response is, you know, just do these three easy things or, you know, just do X, Y, Z and you'll be the next Powerball winner. That can be really just bad for sustainable company development. And, you know, it's funny when I meet with entrepreneurs sometimes, I will see their deck and it will be, you know, we'll go to the financial slide and it will be very clearly, you know, we're going to triple this year, triple next year and double the following year. And I often ask, like, do you believe this or is this just what you feel like you need to put on a page to get, you know, venture interest? And it's always, almost always the latter, that it's not necessarily what the company can naturally do, how the company should naturally grow and progress, but the latter, just this is what they feel like the venture community needs to see. And so when we started thinking about why that is, you know, when we started working together, my partners and I over a decade ago, there was no early stage venture firm that was over $1 billion in size. You fast forward to today, there's tons, right? And you know, the fundraising, I think the last year there was 150 billion raised in venture. 10 years ago, it was like 30 billion, right? And so just the asset class has matured in terms of amount of capital. I'm not sure it's matured in terms of its thinking and creativity in terms of company development. But really what that does is if you have a billion plus of early stage venture capital or really any stage to deploy, just from how much time you're spending with companies and the like, it's really hard to be really thoughtful and creatively prescriptive, I would say, to the specific company's situation. And keep in mind that the early stage venture model in particular is really a game of portfolio theory. So, you know, that model and that math equation that they're kind of shooting for is a fund level return of X, you know, call it 4 or 5 times. But to get to that fund level aggregate return, the expectation is, you know, I'm going to work with 20 companies and 6 or 7 are going to zero. And I know that I'm at peace with that. And the others really need to make up for that, those zeros, right? So you kind of have the saints and sinners kind of portfolio model. It's fine if you're the portfolio manager, right? That's okay. And you know that, and your LPs know that. If you're the company, it's not really okay, especially if you don't know it, right? And so our whole mantra was, you know, really just about that model, the growth at all costs model, the unicorn or bust, has really been kind of pushed to the fore from the venture community, right? Not because it's the best thing for the company or the healthiest thing for the company to do, and not because it's what the entrepreneur thinks they can do or should do, but really because it's what the venture investor needs. And so, you know, our model is just very different. The stat that we talk about is called capital loss ratio. You can almost think of it about it as like churn rate, right? So if you're investing in 10 companies, the venture asset class on average has a 3.5 kind of churn rate, 35% capital loss. So 3.5 go to zero out of the 10. That's like horribly misaligning if you're an entrepreneur, right? And so you know, or you might not know, but you should know that, you know, if you take money from XYZ venture firm, and by the way, some firms have a much higher capital loss than that, there's a big chance that you're gonna have to do things and do really unnatural things such that you're gonna get pushed to burn out, right? And so the things that they'll do, in particular to your go-to-market organization, like hiring 100 reps when you know have just hired a cohort of 2 or 3, that's really unnatural, and it's not necessarily the healthiest thing for the company. You might get lucky, and if your market and your product and your solution kind of all come together at the right time. But it's very often the case that you get burnt out, and you just don't need to do that. And so I'll pause there for a second because I threw a lot at you, and we can go into any element of that. But our model is just very different. I can talk about what we do differently in a sec.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this move, or I guess this like continued acceptance of the unicorn or bust, the growth at all costs model, partly fueled by the fact that the expectations from venture capital, private equity is so extreme. And we hear that all the time, like audacious growth goals, like huge growth goals, extreme growth goals, all those kinds of things. And I think it's interesting that you asked that question of like, okay, so are these your growth goals, or are these the goals that you know you have to put on paper in order to get funding? And that being really commonly the answer being the latter. So let's talk a little bit about—
Just to interject there for 1 second, Sarah, if you think about that too, my job would be really easy if I just pushed this one mantra to every company I work with, right? That's the easiest thing in the world that you can do. And like quite candidly, from a time management perspective, if you're working with 20 or 30 companies, it's really hard to spend enough time to get to know those businesses. And, you know, oftentimes our peers and you know, venture brethren are generalists. So they're like, they're not only working in B2B software, it's like healthcare and crypto. It's just really hard to be deadly in all of those things and really kind of, you know, focus on the right things for each company. And so it's, you know, the easiest thing I would say to do if you're an investor, it's also, pretty, just kind of logically set up too, because if you're a venture investor and we, there's another kind of juxtaposition of to our model. One of the huge kind of pernicious issues with venture is, you know, typically, and especially in the last 10 years, solid paper returns, but like very little actual distributions to your LPs, meaning, you know, you invest in a company, push it to grow heavily, get the next investor to invest more at a higher price. And so you can mark up your portfolio nicely, and your investors, you know, think that everything's going great. It's really hard at times to sell those companies, right? Or get liquidity. And so a big part of our model too is just really pragmatically aligning with teams. And it's not a good fit for everyone, by the way. Like we actually, you know, similar to how our companies think about ideal customer profile, we think about our ideal entrepreneurial profile. Like, who are we selling to? Why do they care? What do they need? And oftentimes it's really helping them get liquidity in an asset that was otherwise very illiquid, right? So take our capital, and we're going to help you grow with resilience. We're going to talk about how you grow from like, you know, 2.5 to 5. versus, you know, pitch my partnership on how you're growing from 2.5 to being a $1 billion company in 3 years. That's just kind of crazy. And we have several case studies as to where the first proverbial peak, we call ourselves peak spend, because we think that growth company development is really a series of successive peaks of value creation. You know, don't like chart your course to the summit on day one, but rather let's get to base camp, then, you know, camp two. And so we have a bunch of case studies where, and CloudBeds is one that's a great example, a company I'm on the board of. Their business was $2.5 million of revenue when my partner Phil and I met them in 2017. There were 30 people in San Diego. And our kind of first proverbial peak that we aligned on with the two founders, Adam and Rich, was how do we grow from 2.5 to like 7 over the next 2 years with resilience and good unit economics? And by the way, that's hiring like, you know, two sales reps per cohort versus 15. And we did that, and it was going really well. And then we said, all right, let's recalibrate. We're at 7 now. We have a lot more data, and we have a bigger team. Let's now chart to 20. But it still wasn't, let's get to $1 billion. We did that, and it was everything was going great. And there was a real kind of opportunity for category leadership. And so we brought in Viking, a hedge fund, for $50 million of investment. Continued to go great. And then we just closed around with SoftBank for $150 million of investment at almost unicorn value. I think that's a great example of just kind of a rebuttal to the logical question that people ask about our model is like, are you limiting growth or are you like metering, you know, potential of companies? And I really would assert that we're not. We're just helping you get there in a more aligned way with more optionality, with better resilience as you go. And so we have now three companies that are approaching that status. And that's not our model. Like, we don't need those, you know, unicorn outcomes, but I think it just shows that, you know, if you kind of logically align with the team and your investors and your board, really good things can happen. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So you mentioned kind of one of the risks with this, you know, growth at all cost model is that while your valuation may go up and you kind of keep chasing that next round of funding, it's an inflated value. There's not really an opportunity necessarily to exit, or there is an impending sort of drop off that's somewhere, you know, just probably beyond reach. What are some of those other, I guess, challenges that emerge or risks that you see coming up when these companies try to achieve these incredibly audacious growth goals set for them?
It's a great question. So I'll talk about two of them. So just the valuation piece in and of itself, and this might sound weird, but I really like categories that oftentimes will have a like super well-funded, highly valued competitor that we're not talking to, and we're talking to the more, you know, reasonably sensibly capitalized vendor. That if you raise so much money at such a high price, at a certain point, like there's not many companies on the planet that can acquire you, period, because they don't have the resource to do it. And so oftentimes you're planning to go public or whatever it might be. That's a whole different set of issues too, because then you're reliant on capital market, you know, fluctuations and issues. And so if you raise so much at such a high price, you are really, and often entrepreneurs will tell me that they did that with like, you know, a lot of pride, which is natural. And with love in my heart, I say like, that's awesome. But like, do you know what that means, right? Because if you raise $100 million at a billion pre, you have to be at peace with growing to 3 or 4 billion before you're even considering selling, because, you know, that entrepreneur friendly term sheet that you got from that investor, they're not very entrepreneur friendly if you go to sell the business for $1.5 billion and they don't make a great return, right? That's just not the case. And so that kind of proverbially backs you into a corner. And I see companies do it way too early, right? If you're $100 million of revenue and you do that, that probably makes sense. If you're $2 or $3 million of revenue and you've already backed yourself into this kind of single pass corner, it can be kind of tricky. The other thing too that I would say is when you raise a ton of money early, in particular, regardless of the price, oftentimes you lose that DNA of like scrappiness and really just having to figure it out because you don't have the capital resource base to do so. You know, you're based in Vancouver, Sarah. We love geos like that where there's not necessarily a plethora of growth capital. And so when we find companies, they've just had to grind it out, and that will stay with you forever. If you've raised like $100 million before your pre-product, it's really hard to, you know, to claim that you're capital efficient or really know the value of the dollar. And the really negative that comes with that is you're kind of always raising to get to the next raise.
Right.
And that's like a really tricky way to build a business, because you're, again, reliant on the capital markets or the venture community to fund the business. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, let's talk through taking the other approach, taking this more kind of slow and steady, you know, building resilience, all that kind of stuff, what should leaders be focusing on instead? And you talked about this kind of milestone approach, your peaks. What are those milestones? Walk me through them.
Yeah, it's a great question. So for me and for us, just on day one or even before we partner, we just sit down and have a really pragmatic conversation with the team. And keep in mind, the companies that we're working with, typically the founding team, it's typically the first time they've done this, so they want the help. They typically own a lot of their company because they haven't raised gobs of venture capital. Those two things are really important, right? Because they're looking for a partner, and because they own so much of their business, they can sell for 150 or 200 million and have an awesome generational wealth event where if you own 3% of your company and you're a hired gun Silicon Valley CEO, you probably have to go for a big outcome too until you make a lot of money. And so that's a great kind of aligning dialogue that we have on day one, which is when we get to this first peak, and let's talk about what it is and the resource you need to get there. And, you know, the ostensible value of the company is X. When we get there, we should be making our target return, which is 3 times our money. It's not 10. And you guys should be in a really good spot, you know, personally, financially, and the business should be too. And so it removes a lot of the kind of just opaque stuff that I see with venture a lot, where it's like this black box and you don't know how folks got to their value or why they're interested or not. And so it's just a really candid conversation. Like, we share our returns model. We model out the returns for ourselves and every other member of the cap table, just to show if there's like incredible misalignment between the curves, it's just really hard to have a cohesive dynamic as a team and a board and shareholder base. And so we look to really eliminate that. And again, our whole just kind of model is about iterative, incremental, pragmatic, you know, sensible expectation setting, and really just finding teams that get that and appreciate that. It's impossible for some people to get over. They can't you know get there, and they only focus on the pre-money, and that's fine. That's a big part of our job, is to really qualify those folks out early, because they're just not a great fit for our model. And so we really, you know, we do qualify the type of entrepreneur, the type of business, you know, that we work with a lot. We're really active with our teams. We look to kind of couple our expertise with a bunch of operating advisors that can be really helpful to these teams. And, we're huge on just kind of collaborative dynamics around the table. And again, some companies don't want that, and they don't need that. And they sure feel like they have it all figured out, and that's totally fine. They're probably not a great fit for us.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how sales in particular fits into this, the measured growth, the sustainable growth. What you mentioned, kind of an example of like, okay, let's throw 100 sales reps at the problem because that's the easiest way to scale. What's the opposite of that? What's the best way to approach that?
Totally. That's a great question. So I think, and oftentimes when we're partnered with a business, it's a classic dynamic where they will have, you know, one or two sales reps who is absolutely crushing it and shouldering the mat, like the burden and most of the production that's coming in. And then they'll have several reps that are kind of like doing okay, and then a revolving door otherwise. And so I think, building consistent, repeatable, really distributed sales rep and go-to-market performance is the hardest thing to do in growth company development. I really do believe that. It's where we spend a lot of time with our teams. And I think if you hire too quickly without the data to understand what's working and the infrastructure and, you know, training and onboarding programs, enablement, you know, tools to make people, to give them the best chance of being productive, it's really tough, because you're kind of always going to have that dynamic where a couple folks are doing well, you know, by the way, probably just because they're Renaissance men and women and they can figure it out. They're really quick thinkers versus anything you've done for them. And so we try to kind of bridge that gap more iteratively, whereby, you know, you might have two reps. Those two reps have probably sat next to the founder like since day one. And by, you know, osmosis, they know the business. They're so passionate about the mission. They can sell just by virtue of all of that. And so you're trying to institutionalize that knowledge into your next, you know, 10 or 15 or whatever reps. We have an interesting, I love this quote. It was a business that I worked with called HireVue, which had a great outcome. My partner, Phil, and I, again, we found this business in Utah. They were like $4 million of revenue. They're in the digital interviewing space. And so it's a really neat business. And we went to meet with the founder, and he was 27 years old and picked us up from the airport in his Toyota Camry with busted windows. It was like the windows that rolled down, and mine didn't roll down. And I remember Phil like texting me when we were in the car being like, this is our kind of guy. And that's what I mean by the scrappiness. Like that was awesome for us to see, you know, versus going into the office and seeing like the gold plated piggy in the middle of the lobby and being like, oh gosh, something's being overspent here. So anyway, so the company did really well. We were very aligned with them again about this first peak. Let's grow from 4 to like 10 in the next year or two. And we did that. And then the company really wanted to go for it because they were a clear category leader. The data really asserted that it was the right thing to do. We gave them caution as to what, you know, working with some firms will make you do, even if you're successful. And so we raised $25 million from a tier one firm that will remain nameless. And then we raised $42 million from another firm that was, you know, in that same kind of category. It probably had that same, you know, 50-60% capital loss rate. And the business performed well. However, we spent like a year and a half. We were a large enterprise focused business. The new investor came in and was like, we're going to do SMB now. And so we spent $20 million doing that with a dichotomy of go-to-market motions that didn't work out and was kind of, you know, illogical, but we had a bunch of money to spend, so why not? And then we just ended up hiring people so quickly, such that as the VP of sales, his job was almost to hire people like with as quick, you know, as high velocity as you possibly could. And I remember the founder coming to me at one point after the business was acquired. The business was acquired for $700 million. It was a great outcome. I think it could have been acquired for more. And I think we could have and should have raised less. And I think the founder would tell you that too. But he came to me after we sold and said, I knew it was crazy when I was like walking down the halls of our office and somebody I just hired was training someone. And like, that's the craziness that you get kind of pushed to do. And it's just unnatural. Like even in that scenario where again, clear category leader, great outcome for the business. We didn't need to do all of those things, right? We probably still would have gotten to the same place without that, with a lot more alignment and a lot less just self-imposed stress and a lot more risk-taking too, because that model, you're reintroducing so much risk that you've stripped away so methodically to get to a certain level, right? And then you just kind of reintroduce it and re-self-impose it by hiring too quickly and taking all these operational risks. And it's just not the right approach in my view.
Yeah, interesting. And what do you say to somebody who's listening right now, and maybe they're, you know, an early stage founder, and at this point, bootstrapped, thinking about potentially going for funding or whatever in future? They can't all work with you. You mentioned you qualify, you have a small list of people that you'll work with because you want to be able to be kind of close knit and make the right decisions and kind of work alongside them. So what is your advice to those founders out there that want to raise, but they want to raise the way that you've taught us to?
Yeah, it's a really good question. First of all, they can all work with us, and we'd love to work with all of you listening. I think just a couple things, like capital efficiency, sound unit economics, growing sensibly, like those things have always been cool and will always be cool. And so don't get pushed to putting things on a slide or, you know, again, making decisions for your business. It's your business. It's not the Valley's business. That aren't right for your company. And by the way, like a lot of categories of software, in my view, don't necessitate that growth at all costs or that like crazy investment posture model. Some do, right? And so if you've chosen to be a business leader in a category that has 95 venture-backed competitors and they're like just absolutely taking the oxygen out of the room with funding and marketing and awareness, you might need to pursue that and it might be a little unnatural, but I would just say, just take control and maintain control of your business. Investors, like the best thing we can bestow on a company is the benefit of our experience. But, you know, we are not there. We shouldn't be there to get in and you know, pull the operational strings of your company. And you should be emphatic about that, because if things are not right for your company, nobody knows it better than you. Just stay the course. And again, I think the concept of resilient value creation and sensible scaling and pragmatic growth, like those things will always be cool. I promise you, some of the unicorn mania and this kind of boomer bust stuff, like it's in vogue and it'll come and go. You know, I think one interesting kind of anecdote is, you know, we've seen the markets kind of compressed on the SaaS side in the last couple months. It's interesting, right? Because now you see a lot of these high flying momentum investors that we're pushing this model now talking about like profitability matters. And so it's interesting how quickly they might, you know, change their tune, but you know, again, I would just say, just be empowered to grow the business at a natural rate that you know is sensible and palatable for the company.
Awesome. Well, it was so great having you on the show. Learned so, so much. If people want to get in touch with you, if they want to learn more from you, where can they do that?
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. It's a real pleasure. I have one last anecdote because it is predictable revenue. when I was first getting into venture in 2011, my then future co-founder actually was my first interview. He asked me what I knew about software companies, and I knew nothing. And I said, I think they have high gross margins. I literally knew nothing. And about 2 months later, Predictable Revenue came out, and it's the first book I bought to try to get smart on the industry. And it stayed on my desk for the next 10 years. And it's still on my desk now, even though I'm not in the office. It's on my desk, I promise you. And actually, one of the companies I work with, Cognizm, just brought Aaron Ross on as an independent board member. And so I told him the story, too. And I was like, it's kind of come full circle for me now being on this podcast and being on a board with him. So just think highly of everything that you all do. And you've got a great reputation. So really just privileged to be here. You can reach me at email, matt@peakspancapital.com. You can go to our website and check out some of the materials we have there. We have a section called Scaling HQ, which is all about just kind of best practices that we've learned over the years as to how to scale with resilience. And so we've got some great content, a whole masterclass series up there. And so we'd love to be helpful. You know, I got into this business to work with entrepreneurs and to be helpful. And I'm always happy to do it. If there's a fit to work together, great. But if not, then no worries at all. So please feel free to reach out.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely point everyone in the right direction and include that in the show notes and the blog and all that. Yeah, once again, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to all of you for joining us for another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. Please, if you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button on YouTube so that you can be notified each week when we have wonderful guests on like Matt. We'll catch you next time.